Good morning. So previously, we looked at finishing up Huffman coding, and we talked about mostly little details that will come up on the lab. So one thing was how we go once we know what the Huffman code is and we've written it down somewhere, how we actually apply that to take something encoded and translate it back into its original list of symbols. And the basic idea there is that you'll have a written down list of the translations. You construct that prefix tree from them. So if you see 001, you say, going around from the root, we go left and left and right. You add nodes as appropriate. And when you read everything in, you have your full prefix tree. And you can just apply that going one node down the tree with each bit until you get to a leaf. We also talked about little details about the lab format, about what the format of the files was, and a note about printable ASCII, which I understand from talking to Florian is like the most common problem with the lab, is that people don't pay attention to that we only want you to process printable ASCII characters, which means hex 20 to 7e. And people often apparently make mistakes with that, where they, especially with other white space characters that we don't want you to deal with. Okay. Then we moved on to graphs. So you talked about basic definitions for graphs. We talked about the two kinds of graphs we'll deal with, directed and undirected, and we'll see that we'll be switching between them a lot when we talk about different things we do with graphs, since different applications make different ones make sense. We talked about definitions of paths and cycles. So paths was we just went on some edges and chose the vertexes based on that order, possibly with repeated vertices. And cycles was we had a path which went back to the beginning where it started. We talked about the notions of connectivity. So in an undirected graph, we had just the idea that connected means that we could find a path between every set of vertices. For a directed graph, we had to be a little more careful because the paths are directional. Just because we have a path from A to B doesn't mean we have a path from B to A. So we had two definitions of connectivity. We had this weak one where we just said, let's do the same thing we do for an undirected graph, pretend all the edges go in both directions, and strongly, where we actually required a path both from A to B and B to A for every A and B vertex. Then we talked about, well, we know these definitions, we've drawn these pictures, we've given a formal definition where we say we have ordered pairs and lists. What are we actually doing in our computer to represent graphs? And we had two big options. One was adjacency matrix, where we had a matrix with an entry for every pair of vertices, including a vertex paired with itself, and no list of things. And this had the advantage of being a fixed size for any graph, had the disadvantage of if we don't have many edges relative to the number of pairs, we're probably wasting a lot of space. That's the advantage that if we are using most of those edges, it's probably more compact than an adjacency list. Adjacency list where we just had a list of the edges out of every vertex. So that had the advantage that it's generally easier to figure out all the edges from a vertex, and it's much more compact if we don't have most of the possible edges. If like most pairs of vertices don't have edges between them, which is true in probably most graphs that we actually use in practice. So now that we've gone through these representation issues and definitions of graphs, we're going to start talking about things we want to compute about graphs. I'm going to start with something we'll call a topological sort. And this is something we're only going to define for directed acyclic graphs. So directed graphs, so the edges all have directions, and acyclic, so we're never going to have a path from A to A that isn't the trivial path with no edges. And the idea of a topological sort is that we're going to order the vertices such that we'll have a vertex after another if there's a path. So, for example, vertex C here will always put after... Wow, I did the wrong sort, okay. We'll always put after F and A. That was an incorrect sort. Okay. But so vertex C here, it always needs to be after A and F because A and F point to it. So there's a path from vertex A to C, so it has to be after A. There's a path from vertex F to C, so it has to be after F. And similarly, vertex B has to be after C because there's a path from C to B, and it has to be after A because there's a path from, there's two paths, in fact, from A to B. There's the one that goes directly and the one that goes through C. D, for similarly, has to be after C and after B and after A, because there's paths from all of them. So when we have a correct topological sort, which was apparently not the first one I wrote on this slide, I don't know, interesting mistake to make, we can look at these vertices in order and say, if I go backwards in the list, you know, I'll find paths. But otherwise, you know, if I look at A, there's not going to be paths to A from anything after it in the list. And if I look at B here, there's not going to be paths to B from anything after it in the list, and so on. And there's multiple possible orders. So for example, in this graph here, we have A and F. Both have no edges coming through them. That means there's no paths to A and F from anything else. So either of them could go first in the topological sort, and you know, it's arbitrary which one we choose. Just like in a real sort, you know, there's some things which are equal. These are equal as far as our topological sort is concerned, even though they're clearly, you know, distinct vertices. Like we can say, we can distinguish between them by saying, you know, only one of them has an edge to B. And similarly, we have H here and E, and these have no outgoing edges, so they better be at near the end of our topological sort, but there's no ordering between them because there's no path from E to H or from H to E, so it doesn't matter what order we put them in. And this can also hold for vertices that are in the middle of our topological sort. So if we think of, for example, D and G here, there's no ordering between them because, again, there's no path from D to G or from G to D. So it doesn't matter what order they appear in our topological sort. So this is not giving us a complete order over everything because the edges don't actually determine the full order. So we're going to just want to find any possible order, and we want to do that efficiently. So any questions about the definition of a topological sort? Okay, so given that, let's start with the simple case. So what are the possible topological sorts? What are all of the answers my find the topological sort of this could give? And how many are there? Two. Okay, so what are the two? A, B, C, D, and A, C, B, D. And how can we show that we don't have any others? Yeah.
A must be first and B must be last. So the only first.
Yeah, so A we know must be first because there's no path to A from anywhere. And also, if we look at every other vertex, there's a path from A to it. So A absolutely must be first. And similarly, if we look at D, D must be last. There's no path to D, sorry, from D to any other vertex. So there's nothing that it needs to be after D. And if we look at every other vertex, there's a path to D from it. So it has to be after every single other vertex. And therefore, we only have B and C. And it turns out, if we look at both of the possible orderings, that they're both fine, that they're both valid topological sorts when we check, is there a path from, you know, from B to C? We say no. Is there a path from C to B? We say no. So it doesn't matter how we order those two vertices. Okay. So those are the two there. So let's say I change this problem by adding a vertex E. How many topological sorts are there now? Yeah. So the question is it required to be a connected graph? So if you look at what I said here, it says directed acyclic graph. So your question is, do we meet this property? So is this graph still directed? Yes. Is it still, does it have any cycles? No. So this is still a graph I could ask you to give me a topological sort of, even though it is not connected.
We don't know where E goes because there's no path from BI to BJ.
Yeah, so E doesn't have, we don't, you say we don't know where it goes. I like to look at it as we don't have any restrictions on where we put it. So we can put E anywhere. So if we add E, our possible topological sorts are E, A, B, C, D, A, E, B, C, D, A, B, E, C, D, A, B, C, E, D. We can just put it anywhere and do the same thing with the other ordering before we added it. So it ends up that we get 10. Okay, questions about this? And of course, things would be different if I drew an edge to or from E and it, to any of the other vertices. But right now, we have just no restrictions on where we put E. There's no association between E and A, B, C, or D. So it makes sense that it doesn't matter how it's placed within them. It just needs to be somewhere. But alluding to the question of like, when can we not do a topological sort? So here's a case where we can't. And this is because this is not a DAG. Not a directed acyclic graph. In particular, it's not acyclic, it's certainly directed. And we can't do a topological sort of this because anything we want to put first, we're going to say, oh, there's a path from another vertex to that. We can't put it first. And again, we'd still not have a topological sort if we added E. So E, indeed, we can sort relative to A, B, C, and D, but we still can't place A, B, C, or D in our list appropriately. We don't know which one is allowed to come after. Allowed to come first or last. Okay, so that's definition, going through examples of a topological sort. So why is a topological sort useful? Well, one example is something like a prerequisite tree. If we're deciding what row to put everything in, we're really doing a topological sort. Because it's the case that things in the top row have no edges to them. Things in the middle only have edges going down or coming from above. And this is, so to figure out what level you put each thing in, if we just gave you a list of course prerequisites, you do a topological sort, that would tell you the levels you can use. You just get the nodes in a topological order and you figure out when do I go to the next level after you have that order. So that would be a step of drawing this prerequisite tree in an automated way like this. So we have this definition of a topological sort, and we can do it by hand, probably. But we'd like to write programs to do it. And for the purpose of that, I'm going to have a couple definitions, or probably just one. One definition, yes. And that's going to be of this something we'll call an indegree. So the degree of a vertex is the number of edges. The indegree is the number of incoming edges. So we also have some other related terms, which we won't use, because we just don't have a case where they come up, but like out degree is outgoing edges, and degree is number of edges, which degree is the term you'd use for an undirected graph, but here we care about the indegree. And the association between the indegree and our topological sort is that if a node has no incoming edges, well, it better go first. Or it's one of the nodes which could go first. And so our intuition for sorting is that we're going to take one of the things which has an indegree of 0, which could go first, and then we're going to solve the problem in a sort of a, you know, recursive way. We're going to say, let's say I put A first. Well, I know there's no paths that go to A, so I can just solve the topological sort problem by pretending that A is not in the graph anymore. And when I do that, I find out, oh, I can say, okay, I just have one edge to B and C now. Because once I have put A in my topological order, I don't need to care about paths that come from it, because I've already taken care of making sure it comes earlier. So once I've decided I'm putting A in the order, I can just remove it from the graph concept, you know, and say I'm just going to deal with everything that remains in the graph, because I've already dealt with putting A first. And there's nothing that can disrupt that decision to put A in the topological sort, so I can just sort the rest of the graph now that I've taken care of A. So once I do that, I remove F, and again, and it's edges, so I update these, and now I find out that I have, the thing I have to put after that is going to be C. So, questions about what I'm doing here? Yeah. So the key property we're using is that if I know something comes first in the topological sort, I can figure out the order of the rest of the graph by removing that thing that comes first and sorting the rest of the graph, because removing something that's earlier from the graph doesn't change the order of everything else. So given that, our algorithm in sort of pseudocode is that, you know, we have to place all the vertices, so we find a vertex of degree 0. We don't care which one, because there's multiple orders, but we only care about getting one of them. And if we can't find one, that means the graph must have a cycle. So that's not obvious, but it does happen to be the case that if there's no vertex of degree 0, we know there's a cycle. A way you can prove this is by if you look at any vertex which is an incoming edge, you know that you have to be able to go back to another vertex that, you know, you can keep following the edges backwards, and eventually, because you never run out of edges to follow backwards, you're going to end up at some vertex you visited before. So there must be a cycle if we don't have a vertex of degree 0. And so we push that back, and we just delete all the edges from it, from our graph. So the way that looks on this graph is we start by saying, okay, we had two choices for degree zero vertices. Let's say we choose A, we remove its edges, and now we have the rest of the graph to figure out the ordering of. So we want to find out what's first now that we've taken care of A. So we removed all the edges from A, we're not considering it anymore. And then we look at F. And we say, okay, so F is the only degree zero vertex left at now. So conceptually, something I guess I didn't write in the pseudocode is once we've added A, we cross it out from our graph too. I'm just leaving it here so you remember where it is. But conceptually, we want to just cross it out from our graph. So we add F, remove that, and now of the vertices we have remaining that we haven't added to our result, we have a couple candidates with degree zero. We have C and H. So we can add H and then C, and when we add anything with any vertex to our result list, we remove all its outcoming edges and conceptually just remove it from the graph. We just deal with the simpler graph with that vertex deleted. So then we have B and G, we add those, and again, when we add them, we remove their edges and remove them from the graph we're dealing with, so we end up by adding D and then E. There was an edge here. And so this matches with our pseudocode. I should have said g.delete vertex v is something we're going to do too. So we make sure when we find a vertex, we don't find one we already used. So that's sort of the conceptual algorithm. So what's the runtime of doing this? So we're doing something based, we have a loop which executes based on the number of vertices we have. And in this loop, we're doing this find vertex of degree zero operation. How expensive is that? Yeah. It's linear time. And linear time in what? So we have two quantities we could think of being our sort of n. We can think of it being the number of vertices or the number of edges. So we have to scan every vertex, every edge, or every vertex and edge. In terms of, so that's kind of a trick question because it depends on our graph representation. So if our graph is represented as an adjacency matrix, indeed, we have to look through all the edges in the worst case. Because if all the vertices, we have to like, there might be only one edge for each thing, and in an adjacency matrix, we're scanning the entire row. In an adjacency list, we look at the list for each. We still need to scan all the edges too. So, but with an adjacency matrix, we're scanning all the edges, but we're scanning all the edges by scanning the entire rows for each vertex, so that's V squared work. In an adjacency list, we're scanning all the edges, so that's work proportional to the number of edges. And this is assuming that we only have representations of outgoing edges. So if we only have outgoing edges defined in degree zero, we're looking through all the edges and counting up for each vertex how many edges did I see. So there's an obvious way to speed that up, which is to track as we delete edges, how many edges there were incoming to each vertex. So we could track the n degree and do that. But the naive algorithm is, you know, more than, you know, we have this big scanning step, which if we are just representing the graph the way we talked about, this is order, number of edges, things. So the total time is going to be the number of vertices times the number of edges, which is pretty bad. If you think of a graph with, you know, with where you have like an average of like three edges for each vertex, this is basically n squared sort of things. So let's say we want to implement this more efficiently. So we have two issues. So one is that the algorithm I gave you modifies the graph. So if we want to do this and then use the graph afterwards, we're going to make a copy of the graph. We'd really, you know, because we want to have the original graph back. So we really want to do this where we don't make a copy of the graph, but we keep track of like what edges we've dealt with in some aside data structure. And the other thing is that we want to find these n-degree vertices, and what you said is that I'm going to scan all the edges. Like, that's the only way we know of doing it with the adjacency list or adjacency matrix representations we have. So what we can do instead is we can track, we can have an array of the n-degrees, and as we conceptually remove edges, we just update these degrees. So that's the first step, is that we're going to track the remaining n degree, and we're going to decrement that as we find edges from vertices we choose. So this is the same as like actually deleting the edge as far as the n degree will compute, and we only care when it reaches zero. So we don't actually need to track all the edges, because we also know we only use an edge once when we add the node to the result list. And we can avoid scanning the list of vertices for in degree zero. We can avoid looking through this remaining in degree list by noticing that, well, if we just upgraded the degree, if we have that loop that we control, we can just say, when it goes down to zero, then I'm going to add it to the list of things two and q. So in this case, I use a q for that. And every time I make a degree of a vertex go down to zero, I enqueue it as the next thing to add to my topological sort. And so the runtime here is, first, we need to do work where we scan all the edges, because we actually need to get the initial n degrees. So we are going to still scan all the edges, but we're going to do that just once. Then we're going to look through all the vertices to find the things which initially have n degree zero, to look for the things which could go first in the topological sort, and we're going to enqueue all of them. And then we're going to go through all the edges of a vertex, of each vertex we find. So you might say, well, isn't this like, oh, max number of edges? And yes, that would be our upper bound. But we can do better than that. We can observe that in this loop where we go over all the vertices and all the edges of that vertex, the maximum number of iterations here, the number of times we do this, is equal to the number of edges total. So this whole loop is going to be proportional to the number of edges we have in the graph, plus, I guess, number of edges we have in the graph plus the number of vertices. because if a vertex has no edges going out from it, we still do some work in the loop for that vertex. So with this improvement, we end up scanning all the edges once to get the initial degree, scanning all the vertices once to find degree zeros. Then we go through all the vertices and edges again to add them to the topological sort and adjust the indegrees. So our total runtime here is going to be proportional to the number of vertices plus edges, assuming our all our other data structures are constant time. Okay, any questions about this? So, and I guess one I should talk about is that you might complain this data structure doesn't look constant time. So in the version of this, which is actually theta v plus e time, that map better be an array where the vertex has an index like 0 to n. Because if it's a hash table or a balanced binary tree, obviously that doesn't, then you have to add this log factor. But fortunately, we can just say, let's number the vertices 0 to n, then we can use an array for that, and everything's constant time. All the little individual operations. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay, so that's our code for doing a topological sort. So we're just tracking the indegrees as they change rather than updating our list of edges and then computing the indegree from that list. Conceptually, what we're doing is the same thing as let's remove all the edges in the vertex as we add it to our output, but we're just tracking the information in a more efficient way. And we have a queue of the vertices we've found so far that are in degree zero that we haven't processed yet. And so this lets us continue iterating through the edges going out of something, even though we might find multiple new in degree zero vertices that we want to add to the topological sort. And I missed a step here, which is what do we do to detect cycles? So a consequence of a topological sort generally will be that you can tell, hopefully, essentially for free, if you didn't actually get a directed acyclic graph. And the way you can do that with this implementation is that if we finish up and our result size is not equal to the number of vertices, then that means there must be some vertices stuck in the middle of the graph which don't have in degree zero, even after we remove the ones we could add first. And that means that the graph must have a cycle, because as I said, you choose a vertex, you just follow its in edges, keep going backwards, and you'll get back eventually to a vertex you visited before, and that's your cycle. And I have showed you the runtime analysis of this before. Okay, so now that we know that algorithm, we can go through this systematic way. So what we're actually going to do is we're not going to remove vertices from a graph. We're going to say, we're going to compute these remaining indegrees. So that's what I'm showing here, not the real indegrees, the remaining ones. And the first thing I'm going to do is scan this list for zeros, add those to my queue. I'm going to process each thing from the queue. When I process A, I'm going to add the edge going to F. So I'm going to decrement F's remaining in degree and also decrements G. So G became 1 instead of 2, and F became 0. And since F became 0, we add it to the queue. Then I process D for my Q, and I decrement my remaining in degrees on H and E. Those go to zero, because there was no other edges into them. Therefore, I add them to my Q as I'm doing that. And then my next thing on my Q is F. So I add F to my Q, and as I'm doing that, I remove one from the remaining degree of its out edges, which includes C. So C goes to zero. Since it went to zero, it gets added to the Q, and I just keep going. So I look at H. When I process H, I add it to my result and decrement B's remaining in degree from 3 to 2. When I add E, I decrement B's remaining in degree from 2 to 1. And then I process C, decrementing B's in degree from 1 to 0, finally adding B to the Q. Then I process B, and as I do that, I decrement G's in degree from 1 to 0, finally adding it to the queue, and it's the final thing in the queue. It has no edges out of it, and so I put it at the end of my topological sort result. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay. So I'm spending lots of time on this because you'll have to do it in lab. Okay, so another class of algorithms we're going to be concerned about is something we'll call shortest path. And there's multiple slightly different ideas of shortest path, and that depends on whether you have a weighted or unweighted graph. In an unweighted graph, when we talk about a shortest path, we mean the minimum number of edges to get from one vertex to another. One of the path, which is, you know, takes the minimum hops. In a weighted graph, when we talk about shortest path, we mean the minimum weight path. So we're going to take a path and we're going to add up the weights of every edge on that path, and we want the minimum number for getting me from two vertices. And shortest path has lots of applications. So like if you have a map, you represent that as a graph, you want to find out these roadways to take from A to B, shortest path is probably the algorithm you want to use, even if you aren't looking for the shortest way from A to B, because you can set the weights to match whatever attributes you care about. Like if you care about the, you know, most scenic, you can like try to set them based on something matching like scenicness and how long it takes in some way. If you want to figure out how degrees of separation, do the, you know, classic Kevin Bacon to other movie stars game, shortest path is the way to do it. On the internet, we have machine computers that are connected to each other. We want to figure out how to send a message between two. If you want to figure out how to do it in the most efficient way, shortest path is probably what you're doing. Again, even if your notion of most efficient isn't the same as the smallest number of hops, you can set the weights on the graphs based on, say, how long it takes a message to go down a particular connection. Less intuitively, shortest path is actually the sort of basis behind many game-solving algorithms. So if you think of like Rubik's Cube or tic-tac-toe, and you want to make a computer that solves that game, what you're essentially doing is shortest path. And this isn't obvious, but because the question is, what's the graph? And the graph for the game-solving case is each vertex of the graph is a state of the game board or a state of the Rubik's Cube. And each edge is a move you could make. So we can think of shortest path as being the sort of things you do to find out, how do I get to this state? So things based on shortest path are what you'd use for that. I guess tic-tac-toe is probably should not be in here. Single player games, solitaire is probably on there. But for Rubik's Cube, for example, like if you want to figure out how to get the Rubik's Cube in a certain state, you can solve it in this way. So there are several kinds of shortest path algorithms. That produce different kinds of results. So the obvious thing is, I want to get from A to B, tell me the path from A to B. So I have a vertex V and W, I want to get there. Another common kind is going to be single source. I have a vertex V. I want to find out how to get from V to everywhere. which seems less useful, perhaps. And another one is all pairs. I wanted to just find out what's the quickest way to get between all pairs of vertices. Like, I have a list of cities in the US, I want driving routes between all of them. Or distances between all of them. So there are algorithms specialized for each of these cases. And we're going to primarily talk about the single source case. So the reason we're going to talk about the single source case is, first of all, that the single pair case is for the most part, solved using the same techniques as the single source case. We just stop earlier. There are more efficient things you can do when you only care about a single pair, but to understand what those things are, you're going to first do the things you do for the single source case and then make them a little better. So the all pairs case is a little less useful, which is part of why we're not talking about it. The other reason we're not talking about it is that the technique you want to use for the all pairs case is something known as dynamic programming, which you'll learn in algorithms, and we probably do not have the time to explain adequately in this class. Okay, so that's our shortest path. So more formally, shortest path. We're going to have a vertex where we start. We're going to call it the source. Since we're doing single source, we're going to find a path for each vertex x such that the sum of the weights is minimum. If we're dealing with a graph without weights, we'll just say that the weight of an edge is 1 if the edge exists, and if there's no edge between two vertices, the weight would be, you know, infinity. Because you'd better not choose that path. And to understand how to solve shortest paths, we're going to start with that case where we're dealing with an unweighted graph. So we're just going to say the weights are 1 for when the edge exists, and otherwise it's infinity, you can't do it. And the algorithm in this case is breadth first search. Which means that we're going to go out level, you know, one node, then two nodes, then three nodes, then four nodes. So that's where the name comes. This is called breadth first search. We're not going to look at the weights because the weights don't matter. They're all the same. We don't need to check. And you can kind of look at this as a generalization of the preorder traversals we did. So it's kind of like a preorder traversal of a tree, except we don't quite have a tree. We have a few extra edges we wouldn't have in the tree. And what we're going to be doing is just ignoring those edges. So we're going to first visit the things which are closest to our root, our source. Then we're going to visit things which are at the next level from our root, then the next level, and so on. And the difference between this and a preorder traversal is that we have these other paths that we're going to ignore because they're longer and they're not part of any shortest path. So the intuition here is that we're going to start with the source. In this picture, it's A. Okay, and the source, we know the path to the source is going to be, you know, just the trivial path, A. And then we follow the edges to find the vertices at distance 1. And the path to all of these is A followed by that vertex. And then we use those vertices. We know they're at distance 1, so anything connected to them is at distance at most 2. So we use those to find the vertices that are at distance 2. And we keep going, then distance 3, and so on. And so far, this is basically the same as what you did for a preorder traversal. You visited a node, then visited its children. That same sort of thing you do. But a thing we have to do that's different than like how we usually traverse over graphs is we want to track visited nodes. So for example, when I'm going from E, I don't want to go to B and C because we've already gone there. So that we've discovered that we can get to B and C with a two-element path. That is a thing we can do, a tuned edge path, but we don't want to do it because it's longer than something we've discovered before. And because we're looking at distance one, then two, then three, once we've found a vertex, once we've visited it, we know that anything we find after that isn't relevant to our shortest path. So all these paths, like from E to C, you know, that's not going to make our path shorter because it's already at distance one. From J to A, that's not going to help us because A is where we started. So we're going to ignore those, and the way we're going to ignore them is we're just going to track which nodes did we already find the distance of. Which ones do we already know are short enough distance? So the other part of this shortest path problem, with single source shortest path especially, is I said for every vertex, I'm going to get you the path. And that's an awfully long thing to write out. But we're going to have a shorter representation of that. And that's something called a shortest path tree. And basically, we just store the source edge for each node. So all I need to know to find a shortest path from any vertex to A is where do I go before that? So for example, from I just store that if I want to get to A from I would go to C. And for C, if I want to get to A, I go to A directly. So I just store the parent vertex, and I can obviously reverse that to get the children, if I want to actually produce this tree in the more like the format we're used to storing trees, where we store children, not parents. And this represents all the shortest paths. I can find the path to any vertex from A that is a shortest path using just these parent pointers. Note that we have multiple choices in some cases. So in the case of I chose in that previous tree that I would go from A to I via C, but we could have also gone from A to I via D. They're the same length. We just had an arbitrary choice to make, and that's fine. Just like with a topological sort, there are multiple possible answers for what are all the shortest paths. And that's okay, we just choose one arbitrarily. And so what the code for this looks like is we're gonna again use a queue. We're gonna use a queue because as we process the distance one vertices, we're gonna figure out what distance two vertices are we discovering. So we're gonna remember the list we discover at each level and process it after we process that level. And I will call this the frontier. So these are the new set of vertices we've discovered that we haven't processed yet. That's the frontier. And initially, we have our start vertices at the frontier. And we need to track some additional information. And there's two pieces of information we're going to track. So one thing is for every vertex, we'll have a distance. So here, I'm saying the vertex is like a class, and it has a distance member variable. If we didn't want to do that, we could have an array with the same size as the number of vertices with a distance, an array with the same size as the number of vertices with also a previous. The previous here is that source pointer that we'll use to actually write out the paths if you want to discover them when we're done. And so what we do is we iterate through the vertices we discovered in the last level by dequeuing from this queue. And when we get that vertex, we find all the vertices that it has edges to. And if they aren't visited yet, which we can discover by this distance number we track, if the distance is still infinity because we set it to infinity and haven't changed it, then we set its distance to the distance we discovered. We discovered a path from A to it, and we set its previous, and we enqueue it to process its edges afterwards. Notice that by setting the distances to infinity initially, this conveniently gives us the correct distance result for vertices which aren't reachable. So we might have a graph like, you know, this graph, like in this case, there's no shortest path from A to B, it will tell us that. Okay, so next time we'll talk about adding weights to our shortest path and some other graph